The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. Have you ever achieved something, accomplished something big, something you worked hard for, that you were praised for, something you thought would bring you lots of joy and happiness, but at the end of scaling that seemingly insurmountable mountain, you just feel kind of empty or already looking for the next achievement to plan for the next peak? You might call this ambition, or you might call it anxiety. Anxiety fuels me. I'm guessing you already know that feeling if you're a frequent listener of this show. It can help me succeed in ways I don't even fathom because my head's down, I'm focused, I'm always scaling that next peak. We can be obsessed with this process, driven by the fear that we might not make it. And then what happens? We don't even enjoy the success that much. Is this really what we've worked so hard for? Oh, and by the way, that next goal is calling us. We can blame it on our ambition. But today's guest points out that most of us have a really narrow definition of ambition, and it's high time we look more critically at what it means for us and the role we want it to play in our lives. That's one thing that made me want to talk to her. And the other is that while she wrote a recent piece on her OCD, she hadn't really talked about it or written about it much. And so we'll hear about how she got to that point as well. Rainsford Stauffer is the author of a new book, All the Gold Stars, Reimagining Ambition and the Ways We Strive, as well as the New York Magazine article, Could I Still Be Ambitious Without My OCD? And she joins me to speak about her career, her mental health, and where she finds inspiration and drive now. So how would you describe your work?
That's a great question. So I am a freelance writer who covers a lot related to work, a lot related to youth organizing, some higher education stuff, and kind of just under the broad umbrella of how we live and the various issues that intersect and shape that experience. So I don't necessarily think of myself as someone who writes only about work. I'm very interested in how different parts of our identities and our self-worth and how we think about ourselves in different contexts show up in different spaces and the structures that reinforce what that looks like.
That's really interesting. And you put higher ed in there. Why?
I've always been really interested in the system of higher education in this country. I had, at the time, what felt like a very non-traditional experience. It's very funny to say this now because so many people graduated from school online. It's not novel at all. But I left college after my freshman year and spent a couple years just working. When I went back to school, I already had a full-time job. So I was working full-time and finishing my degree full-time online. And just that very tiny snippet of my own personal experience made me really curious in who the system is set up to serve and how, who we think of as students, and maybe what it means to broaden that definition of who a student is and what they could be doing. I think that that just maps on to so many other issues of work or achievement or sense of self that kind of come to fruition, not for everyone, but for some people in young adulthood.
Interesting. When it comes to mental health specifically, who is the system set up for and who isn't it?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think there are probably people more qualified to answer this than me. But
that's all right. I think you're qualified.
In my own experience and just I think in conversations I've had with people either working in the field or people who are experiencing care on the other side, I think a lot of mental health in America is set up for white middle class or upper middle class people who typically have access to health insurance or can pay out of pocket for mental health care. And I think that a lot of those spaces are not set up to be particularly affirming or responsive to the breadth of feelings, of issues, of needs that people are bringing to those spaces.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot in the context of school as well.
Mm. Did your mental health have to do with you finishing online? Are you leaving after freshman year?
You know, it's interesting. I was very depressed my first year of college, but I had absolutely no language to explain the depression. I actually spent a lot of time being quite frustrated with myself because I couldn't figure out how to quote unquote snap out of it. And it wasn't tied to anything that was happening at school. I did make friends. I was doing well academically. It felt like this thing that existed lingering over top of me all the time that really had no source. And so I don't think me dropping out or leaving school negatively impacted my mental health. I actually think in some ways it really helped, but it was something that was definitely present from the time I entered higher ed and honestly, probably before that as well.
Yeah. Like when you look back, do you feel like, oh, I was depressed when I was a teenager?
Oh, absolutely. And I think when I look even further back, you know, I definitely had symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder from the time I was a very young child. And it's something that I've actually talked a lot about with my parents now, especially my mom. I'm very fortunate, very lucky to have parents that would have tried anything to get me the help that I needed, or my siblings, any of us. But that was just not something that was discussed in doctor's offices or communities. Like, I don't know if it had to do with the spaces we were in, but OCD was just not something that ever entered the conversation. And now as an adult, I can draw a very clear through line from some of my behaviors as a child to what is now definitely OCD in adulthood.
Like, what are some of the behaviors?
Oh my gosh, it's a long list. I think it shows up in a couple different ways. So when I was much younger, there was no compliment that I savored more from adults around me than "she is so responsible." So there was this sense, this outsized sense of responsibility, not just for myself, but for those around me, and also things that are not in control of any of us. I remember feeling very strongly that I should be able to control and handle all of these things. And that was kind of my job. I think the biggest thing that stands out as a symptom was the constant checking and rechecking. Mm. And it was everything to make sure homework was complete, that my shoes were in my dance bag. I was constantly checking my elbows to see if I was wearing out the sleeves on my sweaters. Probably the grimmest one is I was really obsessed with making sure the pets in the household were still breathing and would be walking back and forth across the room multiple times in an hour just to check, just to make sure. And, you know, I remember struggling with anxiety or what, you know, people kind of chalked up to just be nervous a lot. And I had a really hard time coping with uncertainty. I really liked to feel safe. I really liked to feel sure. And come to find out, all of these things directly mapped onto how my OCD shows up as an adult.
Wow. So this is super interesting because you have written most forcefully recently about ambition. Mm-hmm. And I want to get into how you think your own OCD and your own mental health sort of intersected with your relationship to ambition. But I wanted to start out by defining ambition. Mm. I was in a meeting and we were talking about ambition and drive. And I was joking about a wonderful client I worked with who was 80. And she would always tell me, "I'm post-ambition," because she's 80. I've done it all. I'm good. And one of the younger people in the room said, "You know, I think I'm post-ambition." Mm. And it was really interesting to hear this, and this shows my bias, from someone who, in my mind, is in the climbing years of their career. Mm-hmm. And they said, "You know, I think it's because I didn't grow up in this country. I think it's because I just wasn't raised with this American notion that ambition is striving." And then someone else in the room said, "Well, I don't think you're post-ambition. I think your ambition is because he had said, I just want to live a happy life. I want to have a good life with the people I love. And they said, well, maybe that's your ambition. And so that was like an aha moment for me. How do we define ambition?
This is such a fascinating question. And in some ways, it's kind of the one that's at the heart of my book, because I learned very quickly when I was reporting and when I was researching that ambition kind of evades one single all-encompassing definition. I know that we think of it as motivation, as passion, as drive, or a strong wish to achieve something. I think achievement is usually in there. But I also don't think ambition exists outside of the institutional and structural forces that shape what it means to be ambitious, who is encouraged to be ambitious, who is told their ambition is too much or too little. I think all of these things intersect with ambition. When I was operating under a personal definition of ambition that was probably at its most narrow, it was very much grounded in a certain type of striving that I better always have a goal. I better not slow down. If I deviated kind of off the trajectory or path that I had set for myself, that inherently meant I had failed. It was very narrow. And in reporting the book, I discovered I should say that I went into reporting the book feeling like I had really lost my own ambition. That was kind of the initial thing that jogged my interest in writing about this just for myself before I ever thought of it as a book. I felt like I had lost something that was the key to anything good I could earn my way into, and was actually quite distressed about that. And so one of the things that surprised me the most over the course of reporting was that not everyone was talking about losing their ambition. I was talking to so many people in all different circumstances, all different locations, all different career paths, who were actually talking about expanding their definition of what it meant to be ambitious. That yes, one can be ambitious about work, but ambition can also exist in so many contexts outside of it. Anywhere we want to pour our care, our attention, our intention into, I think, is something that can be considered ambitious.
Ambition is a loaded word, and for certain groups is connoted negatively, I think.
Absolutely. There's no question. I think all the time about how we think of ambition, how that shows up in different conversations. And I always think of there being a lot of two in ambition. Depending on who you are, it can be too much. It can be too wanting. Why are you demanding all of this? Why are you working so hard? What are you trying to do? Or I think that something that also happens is that it gets flipped. Why aren't you ambitious enough? Why aren't you working harder at these things we think you should be working for? Any failing, any disappointment, anything happening in your life that doesn't go the way you wanted it to, that's your fault. You should have worked harder. And I think that, you know, when we zoom out and look at kind of the norms of ambition and who that was set up to serve, I think a lot of it really is grounded in this normative stereotype of an ambitious person is someone who is typically white, male, cisgender, able-bodied, has some level of access to resources or at least choices in their life on what they want to be ambitious about. And I think it's really important to call that out, because I do think that what happens socially, culturally, socioeconomically in someone's life all shape how they're encouraged to be ambitious and how and if they are encouraged to show up in certain spaces.
I think that's probably true. But I also think that ambition in different communities and different groups is very specific. I know in your book, you look at sort of the social history of American ambition. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
This is one of the parts of this that I had no sense of going into it and was fascinated by trying to piece this together. I found some research that I thought was really interesting that talked about how ambition had long attracted the interest of philosophers and people of all different backgrounds, because it was something that was regarded as such a virtue that led to such significant personal or societal attainment or achievement. as well as a vice that can really inflict suffering upon others in pursuit of one's personal gain. And so that was kind of the space that I started from in this research, that we know that just as often as ambition can be a way to express agency and passion, it can also be used as an excuse for exploitation and is undoubtedly responsible for really significant harms throughout history. As part of that in reporting, I discovered that researchers had done a lot of work on different theories about where ambition, and in particular, American ambition, comes from and kind of how our ideas of it originated. And that included researchers who traced the roots back to Roman politics, some who traced it back to versions of the Bible that mention ambition in regard to sin, others who connected ambition as we know it to colonialism and imperialism. And then, of course, I think that that all ties into capitalism and the idea that what we produce is what we're worth and structures that reinforce that. There's a lot going on there.
I've been listening to an incredible podcast called Empire. And it's a deep dive into various imperial structures, including slavery. And, you know, the thread of the ambition of the young man leaving England to make his way in the colonies is so powerful in all of the stories that they tell. I think that that, to me, is something that we've inherited. And I think that in America, certainly, there's that legacy. There's the immigrant legacy of ambition. That was the narrative I grew up with. Certainly, my father would always say to me, you know, my father came to this country with nothing, didn't speak English. My mother couldn't read or write English. And you're going to an Ivy League college. And that felt like my purpose in life.
As you were talking, I was thinking of some research by Jennifer Crocker, Shauna J. Lee, and Laura E. Park. And it was about contingencies of self-worth as areas of our life where we invest self-esteem, which could be personal or professional success. It could look all different ways depending on, you know, what someone's priorities or what their social context is. And I found it so fascinating that in some of that research, they note that the pursuit of self-esteem is a particularly American phenomenon, grounded and born of our nation's founding ideologies. I don't think that ambition can be divorced from that context of how someone came to it, of how it's structurally upheld in America. And again, who and what we think of as an ambitious person and what we think of as an ambitious act.
So you're saying that ambition is a distinctly, I think the acronym is WEIRD, Western European Individual something, and self-orientated thing.
I don't necessarily think ambition itself is inherently American, but I think one particular...
No, definitely not.
But I do think that the kind of capitalistic, hyper self-reliant belief that all achievement comes solely from one's own hard work. And if you need help, you failed somehow. If you stray off the path, you failed somehow. I think that narrow definition of ambition does feel very tethered to America's founding ideologies and to capitalism that upholds that.
Yes. I think what we're seeing at work that I find really interesting and I think is really distressing to many people is that there is a legacy of the people in charge at many American corporate workplaces who still ascribe to that because they were the beneficiaries of it. I see a clash. And when I read about a lot of the notions of everything from quiet quitting to lack of engagement among younger generations and the frustration that older generations who manage them feel, I see it as a great disconnect in belief with people who are under probably 45 thinking, we've all been fed a lie. I can have all the ambition I want, but structurally I am set out to fail. And then people older, and myself included, who had so much access, who are like, why aren't you working harder?
It's interesting to hear about because I'm someone that is not in a traditional or corporate workspace at all. And just in the young people that I work with, I even feel like there's a really significant, I don't want to say gap, but I think that some of the teenagers that I'm lucky enough to spend a lot of time in conversation with already see this completely differently than I do at my age. I think they've come to a lot of realizations I've had in my 20s much, much earlier in life. And I think that they've seen their parents or their older siblings or their peers struggle and work in these very specific ways where you really are trying to use individual achievement to thwart structural barriers, right. Which is just
a losing battle.
It is. It's not even close to sustainable. It's not grounded in reality. And the thing that I come back to a lot is that it just dumps so much guilt and shame onto the individual because it really does become this very individualized quote unquote failure mm-hmm. instead of structures that are doing exactly what they were designed to do. They're failing people.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
From LinkedIn News, I'm Leah Smart, host of Everyday Better, an award-winning weekly podcast dedicated to personal development. Whether you're looking for ways to shift your mindset or seeking more fulfillment in your life, we've got you covered.
You can build internal resources. That's what the study of psychology is about, building internal resources.
Turning towards is one of the most important elements of successful relationships, no matter what kind of relationship it is.
The thing that underpins all of this productivity stuff is finding a way to make the journey itself enjoyable. The journey is the destination.
The beauty of uncertainty is infinite possibility. When you don't know what's next, you don't know what's next. And thus, anything can be next.
Join me as we dive into captivating stories and research-backed ideas that have empowered me and others to lead lives with more clarity and intention. Everyday Better, making growth an everyday practice. Listen to Everyday Better on the LinkedIn Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So what do you want us to understand about ambition differently?
I think the first thing I would say is that I hope that we can walk away with a more expansive and more imaginative definition of what ambition is and what it can be. Because as I was reporting this book, that's what happened to me. And I give all credit to the incredible people who made time to talk with me and share their stories for broadening my idea and my thinking around not just my own ambition, but what ambition can look like, that it is absolutely valid to be as ambitious about your friends, about your community, about caring for each other, as it is to be ambitious about school and work. And I think that the other part of that is that those things don't inherently have to be in competition with each other. Mm-hmm. Maybe you are someone who feels deeply ambitious about how you serve your community, how you show up to give care, and you happen to be really ambitious about your job. Those things can coexist. But if you're someone that is not feeling a sense of care or intention or drive through your work or through academia, that's also okay. That doesn't make you an unambitious person. And it is okay if you are. Ambition is never going to be the solution to structural and systemic crises because, again, it relies on that individual achievement. So I think when we can step back and have a fuller picture of who and what can be ambitious, it brings us a little bit closer together and encourages us to share those goals or aspirations, not just individually, but collectively as well.
Do you think we're too goal-oriented?
I think we're too outcome-oriented, and at least for me, I do think there's a distinction. I personally really like having goals, even if that's not the language that I would necessarily use for them, and some of those are professional and have to do with my work. Some of them are like, I'm going to get outside every day. I'm going to make sure I call right. my grandfather every weekend. I'm going to make sure the cats are up to date on all their things. So I think that I really enjoy having something that I feel like I'm stepping forward toward or I'm thinking about. I think that can function not just as a source of motivation, but as something that can make you feel really good to have a sense of direction and something that matters to you. I think where we veer off track into outcomes territory is that we are so focused on a singular outcome that, number one, we lose the present moment we're in, which is the only one we are guaranteed. And number two, we lose out on the fact that sometimes our desired outcome, our goal, can change as we change. Our needs can change, that we discover new parts of ourselves, things shift in our life, we find something new we care about. I think that staying open to the idea that you can have one outcome in mind and you might end up somewhere totally different and that is okay is really an underrated thing to learn and keep in mind. I know it has been for me in my own life.
So you called your book All the Gold Stars, which I loved. I actually, sometimes when I'm giving a talk, especially if I'm giving a talk to women, I'll open the talk with an anecdote about a friend and I just dying with laughter that in our late 40s, we are still looking for the gold stars in our homework. And I'm curious why that title was resonant for you.
Oh my gosh, this is so funny because it was kind of born out of, I was writing an essay column for Catapult that we had titled Gold Stars. And it was about the idealization of young adulthood, which was kind of the thesis of my first book, this pressure that you're supposed to have every formative experience in your life in your early 20s, lead this extraordinary life. And if you don't, you're behind. So it was already kind of ingrained, I think, in the thinking for those essays. And when I got to the place where I wasn't just writing about ambition for myself, I was thinking, okay, there's so much here. I can't cover it in a single piece. I want to talk to people about this. It's going to be a book. Honestly, it didn't feel like there was any other title that would have worked. Because when you say earning a gold star, I think that most of us know exactly not only the symbol that we're talking about, but also the feeling that that encounters. I think it's really funny how this has become a stand-in for so many things, kind of for achievement overall.
Yep.
And I think it's interesting that that's, you know, a symbol that people recognize.
It really is. And, you know, I come at it from the position of sort of the anxiety cycle of seeking the gold star because it validates us, getting the gold star, feeling validated, but immediately feeling anxious because if we don't keep getting gold stars, no one will love us.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And this is actually probably the part of the personal writing in the book that took the longest for me to unpack. Because I exist in a little bit of a weird gray area where I had all of the anxiety and energy and focus of a quote unquote star student and very little of the results to show for that. I was the student who was going to try the hardest, who was going to show up early to go to all the extra tutoring sessions because she was failing geometry. I was very self-motivated in the sense that I wanted to do a good job. I wanted to be validated by the people around me. I wanted to make sure they were okay with the job I had done. But kind of at every turn, I like reached out to grab our sort of quote unquote metrics of success and just missed. It was a very, it was very uneven academically. I was great in English. I loved to write and anything else. I was just not there. And I think for a long time, it actually really puzzled some of my teachers, especially in high school, because all this effort was there. Like I very much wanted to be the teacher's pet and the reliable one and the one who was doing okay at everything. And the results just weren't there.
Oh my gosh. I feel like that is like the saga of the neurodivergent so often, you know, where it's just.
It was not working. And then, you know, we had, again, didn't really know it at the time. We had chronic illness that impacts a lot of stuff, but primarily my GI tract. And so I was also the kid that was going to the bathroom just like an obscene amount. People thought it was ridiculous. I remember like when I was in third grade, peers thought I was a baby. My teachers thought I was trying to get out of doing something, which was not true. But when you're a third grader, you don't have the language to explain like, hey, I think something actually might be wrong. I'm not doing this just for fun. I'm not doing it to get out of doing times multiplication tables, though I would love to. Mm-hmm. I would love to get out of doing that, but I'm not.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
I think all the time about like how ableist a lot of the policies in school are, and I will die on the hill about raising your hand to go to the bathroom for the rest of my life.
I mean, I see it with my, I have three kids and the value of social control.
Oh my God.
As one of the values that people should strive for, you know, good behavior is something that you actively get rewarded for in our school system. And part of that is like, you can't go to the bathroom sometimes. I find it.
Like, what is that?
I know. I find it ridiculous. And I think the ableism thing, obviously, we know it is so real. What's your own experience been? I mean, you're a freelancer. Is that why you're a freelancer?
That's a great question. So I actually have a full-time job in addition to my writing.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was a job that was remote before the pandemic, which I think helped a lot. And I've been in in-person work environments and I've done okay. I think for the most part, I've been pretty lucky that I had bosses that as long as the work got done, they didn't care if I was spending half the day in the bathroom or, you know, I think with OCD and anxiety and depression, I think that part of the thing I've come to terms with really just in the past couple years is that I've gotten very good at masking that and that that's actually a really destructive thing. So it might be going okay at work, but the masking and the kind of trying to work around all of these things and never really talk about them or never acknowledge that that might be impacting my work was really doing quite a disservice to me. So I think about this all the time now because so much of my work has been remote for so long. I almost can't imagine being back full time in an in-person environment. And at the same time, when I get to go out and report something in person, for example, I really do savor those experiences. Yeah. I think the flexibility and the ability to have agency over my work environment has been honestly, an incredible privilege that I did not even know I needed when I first started working.
Can you dive into the masking a little bit? I would imagine it's just extremely exhausting.
You know, that's a great question. And I should add that I didn't even use masking just now in any sort of like traditional definition when we think of neurodivergence, which I think speaks to the fact that it was something that I was doing for a really long time without even knowing I was doing it because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do. And especially with OCD, when I was first diagnosed, and I, again, did not know this was actually a symptom of OCD at the time, I really doubted that I had it. And a lot of that doubt was couched in, it's not bad enough. So many people have it worse. People are going to think I'm lying. What's going to happen if I'm a liar? I'm a bad person. It just spiraled off in all of these different directions. So I think for a long time, even though I felt like things were off or wrong, even when I would talk to my doctors, I would couch it a lot of the time in, but I'm okay. But I'm showing up at work. Everything's fine. It's not that big a deal. I'm just a little bit uncomfortable. And the whole time I'm like absolutely spiraling on the inside and praying that no one notices that I'm holding it together by an absolute thread. And I think about that a lot of the time in the context of freelance work because sometimes it does feel very precarious. It does feel like sometimes you're only as good as the last thing you did, and you don't want to be the one that falls apart on a deadline. And eventually it just hit the point where that was going to happen regardless of how much I tried to control it. It was going to come out in some form or fashion. And I think that over the past 3 or 4 years in particular, I have been more mentally fatigued than I ever have been. And I think it is because all of the holding it together and hanging on and trying to prove you're okay kind of came to a head all at once in a way where I think my life and my mind were like, you're not going to be able to avoid this anymore. You're going to have to address it head on. And that's going to mean that you shift how you do some things. So we're going to have to do that.
Why did it all come to a head?
So over the past, like I said, I think 3 or 4 years, although I admit that my sense of time is very fuzzy, I had kind of the perfect storm of things happen all at once. There were massive shifts and loss in my family. My personal life imploded. I was trying to navigate a harassment case that I still can't talk a ton about and thus felt like I couldn't talk to my friends or my support system or people around me about. And all of this happened at a time where my physical health, for whatever reason, was just getting a lot worse. I was getting sicker and no one could figure out why. I was trying to sort of patchwork solutions because I felt like I couldn't take time off of work. And it just took the most epic toll on my mental health because it felt like I was watching the bricks of the life I had built and was standing in tumble down around me in every single direction. And at the same time, I think OCD had always been there since I was very little. But I think that something about the harassment situation, which involved a lot of going back to check and recheck, looking at dates, bringing up memories, it unearthed a lot of other memories unrelated to that situation that I had, I think, entirely repressed. And all of that suddenly popped out and was staring me right in the eye. And I had absolutely no coping strategies for that because my strategy before had been, I'm going to throw myself into work. I'm going to literally try to work my way around it. And that was not happening. So I think it was, again, just one of those moments that I know most of us experience in some way where it just feels like it all falls down at once and you have no idea how to pick the pieces back up.
Well, and even worse, you feel like your body's betraying you too.
I felt like I had no control over my body. This was a stretch, and this still happens sometimes, not nearly like it was back then, where I was like trying to work from the bathroom because I couldn't leave the bathroom. But also I was like, I can't take any more time off. If I take time off every time I'm sick, that's not going to work because I'm sick every day to some degree. And so I felt like I had no control over my body, no control over what was happening in my life. And all of a sudden, very little control over what was happening in my mind, which was incredibly disorienting.
What did you do?
So the first thing I did was I finally broke down and reached out for help. I called a hotline associated with a doctor's office that was specifically for mental health and left a voicemail because this was well after hours that was basically like, I need someone to call me back. I need help. I'm very lucky that I have a supportive family and a supportive group of friends. So once I could get it out of my mouth to them that I was struggling and needed help, they really kind of swooped in and carried me and helped make sure that I followed through on the doctor's appointments I needed, that I was safe in the given moment. I think for me, the barrier, which is so funny in retrospect, but the barrier really was like saying, I need help. This is out of control. I don't have a hold of this anymore, and it's swallowing me. I think that once I managed that, the other things felt much more manageable and sustainable in terms of what to do next.
Were you surprised when people showed up to help?
I was shocked, and I shouldn't have been. I shouldn't have been because I know the character of the people around me, and I know that they would do the same for me that I would do for them. But for a really long time, I thought that anytime I expressed a need or a preference or a desire that I was asking for too much, that I was burdening the people around me. And again, going back to the over-responsibility, I really didn't want to do that. I know everyone's busy. They're exhausted. They've got their own things going on. And so I was floored when they showed up and somehow also knew I shouldn't have been. I knew that was going to happen, that they were going to be a safe landing spot for me. But yeah, when that happened, I was astounded.
Do you feel like you are on a path of healing right now, or how are you feeling now?
I do. You know, I think that I've tried to approach this because, again, I think that it's very easy for me to fall into a pattern, whether it's because of OCD, because of ambition, because of my personality, or some neat overlap between all three. I like to fix problems. I like to handle things. I like to reach end results where I feel like, okay, we've done this. Mm-hmm. We can move on now. Yep. Check. We're moving on. I've tried really hard not to do that with both my physical and mental health. And I think in a way, how they have both manifested has made it borderline impossible for me to look at this as I've healed. Yep. I'm done. We're good. We're moving on to the next thing. I've tried really hard to see it as a process and something that is ongoing and is going to require different things at different times. You know, I felt like for the past couple months with OCD, for example, I felt like I was kind of on an upswing. I was like, I'm using these tools and strategies. I'm handling this. I mean, it's still present, but I felt like I had a hold of it in a way that it wasn't controlling so much of my life. And the week before the book came out, it was like something in me just catapulted backward.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah, it was a very, very bad OCD week. And I try to be transparent about that because I know that from the outside, some of it can look very flashy. And in reality, I'm like spending half of the evenings laying on the floor trying to like fight the urge to check that all the doors are locked or to pull chunks of my hair out, like these things that are inherently just not very glamorous. But I think that the difference now is that before I would have been really, really worried if I didn't stay on the track of being fine or being okay. And now I think that there's a lot more acceptance and grace in the fact that I know sometimes I am not going to be okay. And that is okay. That is also part of healing.
I think what I appreciate about what you're saying, and I worry that I get caught up in it too, because it's what people want to hear, is that you're done.
Mm.
You get the therapy, you take the meds, you do the treatment, you learn the skills, and you're done. And the truth is, you're probably never done.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because so much of achievement or ambition does a lot of the time look like box checking, like I fixed it, I'm on to the next thing. I think it can be really disorienting to realize, oh, this is a thing that is never going to be done in the sense that I'm used to things being done. But I think it's been interesting for me because in a way, I have found a profound amount of comfort in that.
Really?
Yeah, which is very surprising. Even surprising to me, I think in a way it relieved some of the pressure to feel like I needed to fix everything about myself immediately and that some of these things aren't necessarily ones that are going to be quote unquote fixed or going to be healed in a neat and tidy way. There are parts of me that are going to be processes that ebb and flow and shift probably throughout my entire life. And in my more optimistic moments, in the moments where, you know, we're doing okay, I think that there's almost been some permission and some ease in that, where it's like you don't have to have every answer, every coping strategy, every treatment you're going to try, everything you're going to do situated right now. It is okay that this can change. It's okay that your needs can change, I think has been my personal takeaway.
Yes. Yes. And that mental illness comes back.
It comes back. It pops up in new ways. I think that that was one of the things that surprised me so much about OCD is that initially I knew very little about it. And again, I'm still nowhere close to an expert. If anyone is listening and wants more specific resources on this, I think the International OCD Foundation is just a phenomenal resource and one that was very personally helpful to me. So not an expert, but I didn't realize that, you know, these obsessions or compulsions, it was kind of like playing whack-a-mole. Like you think you've got one handled and another one pops up. And of course, come to find out, that's because it's really not about those specific things. Like that is a symptom of the disorder, that it jumps to different things. So I think that that's kind of been part of it too, that it can grow, it can change, it can shift. And that doesn't mean that you're not healing. It means that healing is a process you participate in, not necessarily an end step that you can complete.
Oh, I think that's a good place to leave it.
Thank you for such a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. Best of luck. That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.